Well, hey, it's great to have you here with us tonight at Cross Point. My name's Kurt. And if you're here for the first time, welcome. I'm really excited you're here with us tonight. And that song captures really what we believe about the next generation, that we are shaping the future leaders of our world, and they're really have greatness inside of them. And part of our role is to help develop that and make that happen. And so if you're here for the first time tonight, we're in week number two of this series called Navigating High Achiever Land. And we're asking the question, how do we best help the next generation succeed? And part of that comes in how we lead ourselves, in how we kind of model and develop into the next generation, how we ourselves thrive and not just survive. So we're going to look at one of the keys tonight to kind of achieving this greatness. And in any way, anybody that's really, you know, fulfilled their God-given purpose, relationships are a key part of that. And so we're going to look at relationships tonight. And one of the challenges that we have in our current culture today, I mean, it's all of us. I mean, it's not just the young generation, the middle generations, the older generations, it's all of us, is I just think that we're becoming relationally lazy, all right? And it's not necessarily your fault or my fault. It's just that even like right here, like, you know, I carry this around all day. This is one of the culprits, our smartphones, right? Which are supposed to make us smarter and more effective, and yet they seem to make us dumber and relationally stupid, right? And so, you know, we use these devices that try to, and we couldn't live without them. I couldn't live without it. And yet, even though it helps us be more effective in our work and staying connected, you know, at least digitally or virtually, we oftentimes notice that we're becoming more socially and relationally inept. And so if you don't know what I'm talking about, here's one way the phone just plays with our minds. Take a look at this.
Are you a senior citizen?
No, ma'am.
All right, well, then why are you driving 15 miles an hour in a 25-mile zone? Come on, speed it up. Celia's calling.
Oh, it's my girlfriend. Probably wants to start prom plans.
Well, seems like she's very anxious to talk to you.
I would never answer the phone when I'm driving.
Proms don't happen every day.
You sure? It'd just be, like, super quick. It's not...
What's important to you is important to me.
Hey, Celia. Yeah, I can't really talk right now, but...
Put the phone down!
What?
Put the mobile device down now!
No, but...
Hey, eyes on the road!
No! No!
Get your hands down!
Tricked me!
Get out of this car.
You get out
You're
of this
evil.
Car! You prom creep!
I don't think he passed.
Get out!
Wow. Now, if you've never seen that movie, there's a lot more context. But you know, there's something about a phone. I mean, it's like we pick up these devices, and it's like our abilities on certain fronts completely diminish and atrophy sets in. You know, for instance, maybe you've heard of ghosting. Anybody heard of ghosting? Anybody know ghosting? Yeah, a few of the young at heart or younger in the room. Ghosting is where you might be texting someone, you might be interacting on Snapchat or in some kind of interface where you're communicating together. And whenever the conversation goes sideways, all of a sudden one person just stops responding. And they just don't respond anymore. And it's like they become a ghost, they're just gone. And sometimes, like, people that are dating might even find out they're not dating anymore as a result of, like, well, gosh, my boyfriend hasn't, like, texted me in, like, 10 days. I guess we're not dating anymore. He just became a ghost. And we just, like, exit without having, like, the appropriate conversation. And this is happening with employers as well. In fact, USA Today recently reported some really interesting statistics. They said ghosting is happening across industries and occupations. It was always somewhat of an issue for lower-paying jobs. Now up to 20% of white-collar workers in those industries are taking part in disappearing acts. What that means is, you know, employers are hiring not just younger employees, sometimes younger, sometimes middle-aged, but they just don't show up one day. And there's no, like, two-week notice. There's no, like, hey, I don't think I'm really good at this or I want to do this anymore. It's just like, I don't even know how to have that conversation, so I'm just not going to show up. And so they don't. And it's just a sign of this kind of social laziness that we have. And we don't have the skill set sometimes even to know how to have these, like, hard conversations. You know, and like, hey, I want to give my two-week notice. I think I'm going to be done. Like, that's somewhat of a hard conversation. There's things called fubbing, Anybody know what fubbing is? Anybody? Fubbing? Really? A few of us know this? So fubbing is where, like, you might be in a very common place, like, say an elevator is a common place where fubbing takes place, or out in the commons, this might take place, a place where you would normally interact with somebody. You'd walk up, you'd see them, you'd be standing close to them and go, hey, how's it going? Just a courtesy, like, acknowledgement, but instead you just sit and bury yourself in your phone without any acknowledgement. And in fact, this happened to me this past week 4 times within a 30-minute segment of time. I was on a run, actually, and I no more than was at the edge of my neighborhood, and there were 2 construction vehicles, about 6 men, 2 at 1 vehicle, 4 at the other. And when I run, when I run by someone, I acknowledge, I'm like, hey, good morning, or hey, what's up? You know, great to see you today, if it's somebody I've seen before. And so I'll say something to them. I run by the first vehicle, 2 guys on their phones, hey guys, good morning. I'm within 3 feet of them as I go by them. Nothing. I go up to the next vehicle. 4 guys. Now, hopefully these guys don't work for you. You might be really mad. They're all standing around on their phones. They're all standing on their phones, and I say the same greeting. Hey guys, you know, good morning. Nothing. And then I go another like 4 or 5 minutes, and I'm on a path, and I'm coming, I'm approaching a lady that's probably in her mid-60s, walking her dog on her device. I literally, as I approach her, I go within 2 feet of her, you know, as she's going one way, I'm going the other, I say, hey, good morning, nothing. I hear her kind of smirk afterwards. I thought she was laughing at me. She was laughing at something that was going on her device. I go through the rest of my run. I'm like, am I wearing camo? Or like, what's going on? It's like, nobody's seeing me? I get back to my neighborhood. I'm on my cool down walk. A neighbor, a number of doors down, walks out. I kid you not, she walks out to the sidewalk on her device, pulling her dog behind me. The dog's like doing this as it's going down. When I get up there, it's leaving a zigzag pee mark because she doesn't even know her dog's peeing and she's just dragging it along. She's so focused on her phone. And then when I get up to her again, I just say, hey, good morning. You know, it took her like 3 or 4 seconds before she even, you know, oh, good morning. And then right back in her phone. This is fubbing. Now, what's interesting is I started getting a complex. I'm like, oh my gosh, am I like gone and nobody knows it? And I just think I'm here. Like, what's going on? But we all do this, right? I mean, we all do this. And it's not, do we admit we do this? We just stick our head down? Yeah. It's not a crime. It's not wicked. It's sinful or anything like that. It's just that we're in an overstimulated, overconnected, and yet barely connected culture that cultivates relational atrophy. And if we're not careful, we begin to lose some of the soft skills. And in the next generations, they're not even developing some of these soft skills of how to have, you know, just normal interactions, but especially when it comes to difficult interactions. And then here's something interesting. I saw an article just this week about young parents are having to train their preschoolers in courtesy because of, you know, like artificial intelligence assistants like Alexa. I don't know if you've seen this. And Alexa's even beginning to train kids because like kids, 3 and 4-year-olds have began to learn that they can just bark out commands to Alexa. Alexa, start this song, turn it down. And they begin to interact with normal people like this way. And sometimes Alexa will say, well, excuse me, I didn't understand. And they're like, Alexa, you're so stupid. And then parents are seeing their kids talk this way to kids on the playground because this is how they're being trained. And so, you know, it's like we're developing a culture of insensitivity. And so what I want us to see tonight is that we live in a time where, you know, our life is more convenient and many times quicker because of our virtual connection, all the ways that we stay connected virtually. And listen, I couldn't work without this, all right? So it's not, let's just do away with this, but we have to be aware of where we're relationally allowing atrophy to set in and where our relational muscles are just becoming inept. And you don't have to raise your hand, but does anybody know what I'm talking about? Anybody admit that's somewhat of a problem that you see around? All right. So tonight I want to give us some tools to not only help us model and equip the next generation, but how do we continue in our increasingly, you know, virtual world, stay connected relationally, because this is a soft skill that's critical to success. And this could take place with a spouse, some of the things we talk about tonight. It could take place with, you know, a colleague or a friend or a neighbor. It could take place with your son or daughter. And so it's just that many times the most important conversations are loaded with emotion. And when all we know how to do is have conversations this way, but we don't know how to manage, you know, heavier conversations, there's certain conversations that just have to be had in person. And there's certain times that feedback has to be given. And it's only when we do this and know how to navigate these kinds of things successfully that it not only grows us, but our relationships actually go deeper. But we have to be intentional about it. So one of my favorite leaders is on this front is a guy by the name of Tim Elmore. I've talked about him before. And he has a blog, one of my favorite blogs. It's called healthygrowingleaders.com/, which only about half of you are going to get, blog. And you can go to this and subscribe, and every time he posts, it'll send an update in your inbox. I read his posts every time it hits my inbox. It's the one subscription I read every time. And so he is one of today's leading experts on how we can develop the next generation toward greatness. He works with colleges. He works with, you know, Fortune 500 companies. He works with the NCAA. He works with Major League Baseball teams, the NFL teams, NBA teams, you know, educating their executives on how to coach and mentor some of the up-and-coming athletes who don't have these skills. And so he has a resource called Habitudes, which I'm going to give you one of the 16 Habitudes in one of his books, and we have this book available for you tonight if you want to pick it up. It's called Life-Giving Leaders, The Art of Transformational Leadership. And a Habitude is where he kind of takes two images and contrasts them so that we can make visual connects, and it helps us navigate, you know, key principles that we've got to be able to implement in our lives. And I don't know about you, but I'm very, very visual. And so if you're visual, you're going to kind of love tonight, because there's going to be a lot of visual stuff. So tonight we're going to look at developing relational finesse, relational savvy, you know, kind of a relational mojo, if you will. And I want us to do this by looking at these two images that Elmore kind of lifts out, surgeons and vampires. All right, and you're like, what do surgeons and vampires have to do with this? Well, let me explain this to you. All right, so here's how he defines surgeons and vampires. Vampires suck the lifeblood out of a person and operating out of their own need. So vampires are always sucking the life, and they operate for their own benefit only. Surgeons, on the other hand, treat people carefully and instructively. All right, and now here's what's interesting about surgeons and vampires. They both draw blood, but they lead to very different results in the end. And so I want you to think about vampires for a moment. We know vampires, right? I mean, remember Buffy came to slay the vampires a few years ago? And I saw like one episode. I don't know if we have any fans in the room. Any? Okay. I thought it's never going to make it. Never going to last more than like 6 episodes. It went like 144, like 7 years. So, I mean, it was pretty popular. And then, of course, Twilight and the whole Twilight, you know, book novel series and the movie series. And, of course, we know surgeons, right? Because of like TV shows like ER and Grey's Anatomy. And maybe you've been in an operating room. So we get these two pictures. And so I want us to think about this imagery here. And I want to walk out some connects that Elmore makes on how surgeons and vampires help us understand how to navigate relationships and develop kind of a savvy with that. All right, and as we do this, I want you to think reflectively about how you navigate difficult conversations. I mean, when there's a weighty conversation that needs to be had, which one of these do you tend to be like? All right, you guys ready? Ready? All right, are you guys there? Did everybody just come in here tonight and like get your seat and go, like, I just made it. That's what I feel like, and I sense maybe many of us are that way. All right, here we go. So when I'm a vampire and when I'm a surgeon, all right, when I'm a vampire, I'm thinking about me. And so when I'm a vampire, you know, I think about, okay, I got to vent to somebody. I got to get something off my chest. And so, you know, vampires, they feel like absorbed with what I need to let you know. I got to like emotionally dump on you. And I'm going to feel a whole lot better after that, because it's all about how I feel, right? And so I have an appetite for blood. Whereas surgeons, on the other hand, they go into the operating room, at least relationally speaking, and they're thinking about you. They're thinking about the other person. They want to improve you. They want to, you know, kind of, you know, work this whole thing out. And while it may be painful now, it's going to be worth it in the end, because I'm going for the long haul. It's kind of like if you've ever pulled a splinter out of a child's like toe or finger or something. You know, you're like, hey, can I see it? And they're like, no. Can I touch it? And they're like, no. And you're like, well, I've got to kind of get in there, and I might draw a little blood when I dig it out. But in the end, it's going to be short term. But in the end, it's going to be for your benefit. So surgeons are thinking about you. All right. The second trait we see is vampires. When I'm a vampire, I use sarcasm as hyperbole. Now, this is a symptom, by the way. And so, you know, if you're in a hard conversation and you begin to get sarcastic, that begins to become your mode, or you begin to exaggerate, you know, details to try to make a point, beware, because these are not helpful. These are not like beneficial in relational, you know, trying to have healthy relationships. In fact, that's very vampire-esque, all right? When I'm a surgeon, I'll be very careful and accurate. No good surgeon goes and just starts slicing all around the body, right? I mean, the surgeon is very focused. They're going to go in, they're going to take the tumor out, they're going to operate on the one thing that they're going in for. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're not operating on everything at one time. You're going to one thing, right? So relationally, we don't have to go in and talk about all 21 items that are bothering us, right? We pick the one thing and say, okay, here's something we need to talk about, and then we focus on that one thing. Number three, when I'm a vampire, I surprise the person. Vampires are always what? They're always kind of lurking. They're always kind of lurking in the shadows, waiting on some unsuspecting victim. And so, you know, vampires, what do? They prey on people, right? They when you're a vampire, you catch people off guard and try to use that to your advantage. But check this out. When I'm a surgeon, relationally speaking, right, I carefully plan the encounter. Now think about it in a medical field. I mean, surgeons, surgery rarely happens spontaneously, right? I mean, it rarely does. Even emergency surgery, even the most, you know, the biggest emergency, usually there's some process of preparing, you know, the patient for surgery. It's not just like, let's just go in right now and do whatever we need to do. There's a process of preparing. When my wife and I were expecting our first child, or sorry, our second child, Matt, I don't know why my stories are about running. This is fascinating. We were running in the polar bear run. It was like February down in Indianapolis. My wife was walking. I was running with my brother, and she was seven and a half months pregnant. But, you know, she was bound and determined, I am not finished this thing last. And so she's like hoofing it through this race. And my sister-in-law, I just remember being like, oh my gosh, like, Julie, seriously, like, I think everybody that sees you're about ready to give birth, like, you look like you give birth today, even though you're 2 months out. Like, I think they'll understand when you, you know, if you're near the back, it's totally fine. Well, she didn't want any part of that. So we finished the race. She finished. You know, a couple hours later, she starts having contractions. We land in the emergency room. And so, you know, they tell Julie, they're like, you know, you're having this baby tonight, so we're going to begin to prep you for, you know, for surgery. It's going to be a C-section. And she said, I'm not having this baby. I said, no, ma'am, I think you're going to have this baby. And I said, I'm not having this baby. I don't have my camera. We're not having the baby. Which, kids, by the way, that was before phones had cameras. It's like 15 and a half years ago. All right. And so, but thank God that they didn't just go in immediately, because they, you know, they began some of the prep work and checking vitals, and it took a few hours before, you know, they were ready, and over that time her contractions stopped, and they actually pushed off the surgery, sent her home, and she's able to carry, you know, Matt further into the term. But you see, you know, even emergency surgery is carefully planned. And by the way, when we need to have weighty conversations, you know, harder conversations, when they need to happen, the best way to do it is when they're carefully planned. The best way to do it is when both parties know that it's going to happen. And you actually talk about it wisely and constructively. Number four, when I'm a vampire, I look backward at a past flaw. See, vampires get consumed with what you did. Right, they get so consumed with the thing that you did, the thing that happened in the past. I mean, it's like you are so wrong. In fact, you are so wrong. I can't even move past this moment because all I can see is the bad thing you did. Everything about you is consumed. That's all I can see in this moment. I want to show you an image that's really fascinating. Look at this box. What do you guys see in this box right here? Just call it out. Yeah, a dot. How many of you see a dot? How many of you see something else? What do you see? Anybody see white space? Look at all the white space. But isn't it fascinating that whenever we look at something, all we often see is the one thing, even though that one dot is not taking up even a percentage, 1% of that entire area right there? See, this is how it is. When we're in vampire mode, it's like we get so consumed with something that happened, that one thing, that we fail to see the bigger picture of who someone is. In fact, surgeons, on the other hand, surgeons look forward to future possibilities. Even in the midst of something that didn't go the way it was supposed to, or a mistake, or something that went wrong. Now, if you're a parent of a teenager, as you look at these, does it just feel like as a parent of a teenager, you automatically go into vampire mode? Like, just sends you there immediately? Because that's how I feel. I feel like I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm like half of this list already. Right? Is there something about being a parent of teenagers that does that? But see, here's an interesting thing. The difference between discipline and punishment is interesting. Punishment is always looking backward at what someone did. We got to make that right, so we got to punish you. Whereas discipline is looking forward to prepare for the future. Now, the consequence may be nearly the same or the same, but discipline always looks for the future. Discipline goes, you know what? I don't know that that was the best version of you right there. And the consequence may be the same, but I think we got to try to have a better model of you right here. It's always looking forward to future opportunities. There's something known as video game theory that really masterfully illustrates this. I don't know if anybody's ever had a kid, a teenager, that, you know, like you can't get them to sit down for like 5 minutes to do homework and stay focused on it, and yet they can sit in front of a video game for like 3 hours and never get up and be masterful. I mean, they're like skilled at finding their way through this video game. Why is that? Well, it's because there's a theory developing video games. In fact, here's what it's called in this book, Transforming the Intense Child. It says, in video games, incentives are strong and predictable. They confront a child with success. Points are scored. Sounds and visuals provide energized recognition. Video games are always deliver a consequence every time a rule is broken. Notice in a video game, there's consequence. I mean, in fact, they go on and say, even fractionally, if you just barely cross the line, you're done, right? And it does so, though, seamlessly in the moment. See, this is discipline right here. It's not punishment. It's saying, okay, I'm going to show you where that line is. There's a consequence so you know how to do it the next time. The child is back in the game quickly, more inspired than ever to not break the rules again. So video games focus forward. When you die in a video game, what happens? It's like, rah, 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 right? And then all of a sudden, it's like, you're dead, you lost all your players, you hit reset, and oh my gosh, I started over, I got a whole new game. And I mean, nobody comes on at the end of like you losing your third player and you just died and the game ended and goes, you idiot, why did you do that? Why did you put your toe in the lava field? Can't you see? I mean, nobody does that, right? It's just like, then all of a sudden, you just start over. And kids learn. They're like, I know what I did wrong, but that showed me how I need to do it different the next time. And so surgeons are always looking forward, whereas vampires are always focusing backward on the past. Number five, vampires say, I may assault the person's character. Now, this is interesting. You know, vampires, just when they see something wrong in someone, it like consumes them. It's like, all I can see is that they are a terrible person. I mean, that one thing, I mean, I just can't believe they did this. And I can't see a hint of good or God in them, right? And so, you know, because all we can see is the one thing they did. And I mean, we forget, you know, what King David said. If you're familiar with King David, he said, no. He said, you're fearfully and wonderfully made. He said, when God knit you together in your mother's womb, he knew what he was doing. You're beautiful. You're wonderful. Think back to that dot in the white space for just a moment. I mean, all we can see sometimes is the dot, right? We forget to see the rest of the person, the rest of the wonderfulness. Ask yourself, do I tend to focus on just the dot, or can I see the white space, the whole being? And if you tend to do this, if you tend to, you know, just kind of, you see something like, oh, I just can't see past this. Here's an idea. Think of it this way. There's a big difference between poor character and poor judgment, right? I mean, aren't we all like guilty of poor judgment at times, right? I mean, like today I had some moments and I'm like, well, I'm just tired. I'm off my A game today. I mean, you know, we kind of, you know, qualify it with something, right? It doesn't mean we have poor character. John Maxwell, he actually has this little phrase. He says, practice the 101% principle. Find the 1% you can agree on and give 100% of yourself to it. Think about that. And this is not my nature, by the way. I kind of like to see the one little thing, and I perseverate on it. All right, so I have to be intentional on this. When I'm a surgeon, on the other hand, I cautiously remove the problem. So, okay, what's the problem in this situation? What's the problem in this relationship? What's something I need to do with somebody I'm coaching or mentoring or parenting? You know, what's the tumor? What's the cancer in there? And the surgeon addresses the problem area, but it doesn't mean like they think the whole body is sick and bad and there's no good in there at all. I mean, you know, surgeons say, okay, there's one thing here we need to address and it'll affect the whole body. Number six, vampires focus on short-term gain for long-term pain. Right? Meaning, you know, oftentimes when we're in vampire mode, again, it's like, I feel better if I can just get this off my chest. So I'm just going to kind of emotionally vomit everything I'm feeling on you right now, and I'm going to make it your issue, but in the end, I'm going to feel better. And you may walk away and never want to talk to me again. I mean, we may lose our friendship forever, right? Short-term gain for long-term pain. Whereas surgeons, on the other hand, go for short-term pain for long-term gain. You know, having a difficult conversation, it's hard. It's painful. I mean, when you have to have a weighty conversation, when you have to navigate, you know, difficult things. We have to give feedback, and you know it may not be received well. All right, you gotta say, okay, but why am I doing this? It's because I have a belief in this person. I believe that the future can be better. I believe that tomorrow can be better than today. And I know that if we talk this out, it's gonna be painful for a short time. But man, in the long run, there's gonna be an enormous gain. And we've all probably had a conversation that we had that was heavy, it was weighty. And in the short time, it wasn't fun. But man, it made that relationship go deeper. And then finally, when I'm a vampire, my posture is I take life from people. I suck life out of people. I mean, vampires actually make people feel worse, and they usually feel worse themselves. Whereas when you're a surgeon, you breathe life into people, right? You breathe life into people. Now, let's take a look at that. Ask yourself, where do I tend to fall on this page right here? And if I'm honest, if I can just be brutally honest, if I'm not intentional, if I'm not careful, I mean, I tend to be a vampire. I have vampire tendencies. I mean, my emotions get the best of me. I'm a D on the disc profile, almost a turbo D. And so that means I'm like a tank, and I, you know, always going after the mission and the project. And so relationships, if they get in the way, I'm blowing through them. I mean, I'm a vampire at times if I'm not intentional. Which one are you? I want to connect something the Apostle Paul says in the book of Ephesians. And the Apostle Paul, if you're not familiar with the Apostle Paul, the Apostle Paul is kind of new to the whole Christian thing. I mean, he didn't grow up, you know, in faith. He was actually out, he hated Christians, and so he was out to kind of kill them all until he became one. And when he became one, then he began teaching them and being like, oh my gosh, this is great news. You need to consider these things. So he's writing here to new Christians who have kind of walked his road, and here's what he says to them. He says, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths. Now, what's interesting here is we get hung up here. We think this has to do with four-letter words, all right? It doesn't have to do with four. They didn't even have four-letter words back then when he was saying this, all right? So many times we're like, well, he's talking about the F-bomb, and he's not talking about those words. See, here's the thing with Christians. Christians get so worried about the four-letter words, but we have no problem slandering our neighbor, criticizing our neighbor, gossiping. He's talking about those things, all right? So the word unwholesome talk is actually the word sapros, which actually, think of it this way. Sapros is, think of an overripe vegetable in your garden on the ground. Like it's decaying. It's useless. There's no use for it. He says, that's what he's saying right here. Don't let that useless, you know, talk come out of your mouths. It's overripe and good for nothing. But only what is helpful for, look at this phrase, building others up, the act of building or advancing forward, according to what does he say right here? According to their needs. Their needs. How do you know their needs? It's when you act like a surgeon. You know, you focus more on them than you do on yourself. So only what is helpful in building others up according to their needs. Why do we do this? That it may benefit those who listen. Paul says, look for opportunities to bring life, not to suck life out of people. And it's like, how do you do this, Paul? Well, he gives it to us right here. He says, by building others up according to what? Their needs. That it may benefit them. And I've discovered, you've probably discovered this as well, I've discovered that the people that know how to navigate these things relationally the best are the most successful in life. And what's key to all this, what kind of enables me to be a surgeon when I have these vampire tendencies, it's all about my motivation. So we have to do a motive check. I want us to do a little bit of a motive check this evening. So I want you to ask yourself, when it comes to hard conversations, when it comes to weighty conversations that I don't want to have, they're painful, but it's part of what grows us. It's part of what we have to model for the next generation. We have to have them with the next generation. All right, what's my motivation? It's usually one of two things. It's either relief or belief. And so think about it this way. When I operate out of relief, I'm a vampire. When I'm like, I just have to relieve my stress. I'm angry. I'm ticked off. I mean, it's really got me worked up. I got to vent on this because after all, it's all about me, right? I'm going to emotionally explode all over you, and then I'm going to let you clean that mess up. But man, I'm going to feel better because after all, it's all about me. That's vampire mode right there, right? That's relief. Whereas belief is surgeon mode. And when I say belief, when you operate out of belief, it's saying, you know what, I'm going to have the hard conversation because, you know, I believe the best in that person. Even though they may have wronged me or they may have hurt me in some way, I believe that wasn't their intention, and I believe that there's something better inside of them. You know, it's when you look at your son and you go, I just believe there's a better boy than what I'm seeing in there right now. You're not showing me the best of who you are. When you look at your daughter and you're like, I just believe there's a better girl right there than what I'm seeing. See, belief drives our words, and your words begin to operate more like a surgeon. They're careful and calculated and go right to the core. See, when we bring out the best in people is when we believe the best about people. It's when we believe the best in people. And so we have to do this kind of simple evaluation and say, okay, you know, where am I at on this? Now, I want to give you a case study, then I'm going to give you some very practical steps, all right? So this is very fascinating to me. So a study was done by professors a few years ago from Yale University, Stanford University, and Columbia University. I mean, like good researchers, right? Like the best of the best. And they wanted to find out in an educational setting, in a school setting, what kind of remarks from the teacher will inspire those students to actually bring better effort, which is a pretty good question, right? How do we inspire, you know, help students achieve, you know, be higher achievers? And so they took two groups of middle school students. The first was the control group. And basically they took a, you know, an evaluation. The teachers graded it. They marked it up with red ink. And then before they gave it back to the student, they put this phrase on a post-it note on the front of the test. The phrase said, I've given you my comments in red. We've all probably got a test back with, you know, red all over the paper, right? And so this was the control group. And then they, with the experimental group, they began to kind of test a bunch of different phrases. What is it? Is there a phrase? Is there something about what we believe about the student that we can say that will actually change the effort in that student, that will cause that student to get that paper back and then want to go back and correct it and then bring it back to us? And so they worked through dozens and dozens and dozens of different phrases and statements. But they said one rose to the top. In fact, they said one was almost magical. It had so much power. And it wasn't so much in the words as it was in the belief behind the statement. And get this, in Caucasian kids, the effort went up 40% in Caucasian kids. I mean, like 4% in education is a good move, right? 40% is phenomenal. Get this, in minorities and ethnic races, it went up to 320% better effort. All right, and you're probably going, what in the world is the phrase? All right, get your phones out, all right? Get ready to take a snapshot of this. Here's the phrase. It's very interesting. I'm giving you these comments because I have high expectations of you and I know you can reach them. I'm giving you these comments because I have high expectations of you and I know you can reach them. Wow. Well, what's being said right there? Two things, right? I have high belief in you. And I have high expectation of you. And when these students got these papers back, it wasn't like, oh, all this red ink, I suck. I mean, I'm terrible. It wasn't that at all. They got these papers, and what they began to feel was like their teacher was saying, you know, I don't think what you gave me was the best reflection of who you are. I think there's a better version of yourself in there. See, when we begin to believe and operate more like a surgeon, where I'm thinking of you instead of me, when I'm trying to be careful and accurate, when I'm looking forward to future possibilities instead of being so consumed with the past, and when I'm, you know, cautiously and specifically trying to address the problem, the one problem at hand, and our focus is more on short-term pain for long-term gain, I tell you what, not only will you thrive and I thrive relationally, but man, we are setting up the next generation, the generation coming behind us to achieve greatness. Because of high belief and high expectation. So, what do we do with this? I want you to take out your connection cards. We got some next steps. I want to kind of walk us through real quick this evening. Because this is huge. Where atrophy is setting in relationally and socially more and more. And we don't know how to interact. We're not having the weighty conversations. We're not trained and modeled in this. It's critical that we model this to help the next generation be successful, but also so we can be successful. So here's the first next step. I'm going to identify one surgeon trait. Just look up there. Look down the surgeon line. Don't say, oh, I'm going to do them all. All right? I'm like an all-in person. Just pick one. All right? There's probably multiples you can work on. Pick one and say, this week, I'm going to focus on this one trait, and I'm going to try to do this in every interaction. I'm going to tell you, it's going to be hard. You're going to catch yourself and be like, oh, I failed at this. All right? I'm working on some stuff, and I'm failing all over the board, but I'm making some progress. All right? So find one trait up there that you think you can walk out and just say, okay, I'm going to do this week. And the next week, I'll add another one. Or in 2 weeks, I'll add another one. All right, second next step. I'm going to look at every interaction this week. All right, with two things in mind. I'm going to have high belief in the person. I'm going to have high expectation. I'm not going to look at him and be like, oh, that's just a waste. There's nothing good. No, I actually believe I'm not experiencing the best version of who they are. And I just got to figure out why and get to the bottom of that. All right, and then maybe you interact or lead people and you're like, ah, man, this will, it'll take some time, but this will begin to change the culture and the temperature of your relationships. All right, so if you want to commit to either one of these, just declare it. Again, this isn't for us. This is for you to say, okay, God, here's what I'm doing this week. I'm going to work on this week. Third one, this is a spiritual front. You know, maybe God's been building some identity into you over the last number of weeks. You know, maybe you began a relationship with him, you know, by receiving him into your life, whether it was a few weeks ago or last week or a month ago or 10 years ago, but you've never taken the step of water baptism. Tell you what, this is a huge step. And by the way, we have a heavenly father who operates like a surgeon, not a vampire. So many people see God as a vampire. He just sucks the life out of me. No. He wants to breathe life into you. And baptism is about us publicly saying, hey, God, I've received you through Christ, and I identify with you. And it's like, I'm with you, you're with me. There is a validation that comes when we take that step. Maybe that's your next spiritual step. Or the fourth one here, maybe you just say, hey, I'll return next weekend. That's Mother's Day. Maybe bring your mom with you. I'm excited. One of my good friends, Scott Long, a comedian, is going to be part of our services, and we're going to do some dialogue, and so it's going to be a fun weekend as we talk about some of the generational things that you know, just kind of have humor. So it's going to be a great week. One last thing. It's not on your cards, but at Connection Point, we have books that I put on the screen tonight. These books called Habitudes for Life-Giving Leaders. If you want to pick one of these up, they're $12. All right, we're just providing them to you at cost. There's a spiritual version. We have 25 of those. We have 15 that are value-based. Same stuff. The value-based just doesn't have scripture. So it's something you can use it in your school setting. You can use it in a work setting, in a setting that's not necessarily a spiritual setting. If you want them, they're just there because some of us might want to dig into this deeper. The habitude we looked at tonight is in that book. I want to close, as you think about your next steps, telling you a story of the difference that this kind of stuff can make, all right? One of the greatest inventors of the 20th century is a guy you and I are benefiting from right now, Thomas Edison. Thank you, Tom, for the lights that are in this room right now. All right, Thomas Edison, great inventor, right? During his younger years, get this, he was a very troubled kid in school, very, very troubled. In fact, he got kicked out of school. And so here's how it happened. One day he walked home and he had a white piece of paper in his hand, and he got home and his mom said, hey, Thomas, what's that white paper in your hand? He said, well, mom, the teacher, she gave this to me, and she said, Thomas, only your mom is able to read this. She's the only one that should read this. So he's like, mom, I brought it home so you could read it. And so she asked him to bring it over to her. And so she opened up this letter and she began to read it. And as she stood there and read this letter, her eyes began to fill with tears. I mean, she got teary. She got tearful. And of course, Thomas, I mean, he's curious, right? He's an inventor. He's like, mom, what'd she say? What'd she say? Tell me what she said. I want to know what she said. And the mom tried to compose herself, and she said, Thomas, here's what the letter said. It said, Mrs. Edison, your son is a genius. This school is too small for him and doesn't have enough good teachers to train him. Please teach him yourself. And so from that moment on, she began homeschooling him through the rest of his educational career, to which we're thankful for. I mean, she allowed him to invent his heart away, to experiment and chase, you know, ideas. And she just let his curiosity go, and she brought the structure and everything that was needed. And he patented over, like, what, like 2,300, 2,400 inventions. I mean, we're blessed by him. Thanks to that start that his mom gave him on that day. Well, years later, when Thomas's mom had passed away, he was going through some of her stuff. He was going through one of her old boxes, rummaging through some of her old letters, and he found that white piece of paper that his mom had read to him, you know, when he was young. And he picked it up, and he began to read it, and as he began to read it, he thought, these aren't the words that my mom read to me. In fact, this letter said, Dear Mrs. Edison, your son is addled, which means he's mentally ill. We won't let him come to school anymore. We don't have the teachers to handle him. You're going to have to teach him yourself. Now, what happened was the same, right? It doesn't matter which letter he got and which one was shared. That mom, Mrs. Edison, spoke out of belief about her child. And she spoke that boy into greatness, and you and I have been benefiting ever since. She changed his story. Because she said, you know, you see a kid that's really off. I mean, really off mentally. But you know what I see? I see greatness in this kid. I see a kid who has a lot of curiosity and the structure just can't contain him. And I think he's going to do something great. And he might even touch the world. And he did. She changed his story. And for years afterward, he thanked his mom. I mean, he was always giving credit to his mom. People were like, why did you give credit to his mom? Well, the story then emerged. He said, my mom started my inventions. The point is this, whether you're a mom or a dad or a friend or a colleague or a spouse or a brother or sister, surgeons always, 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 always are much more effective than vampires. All right, so let's get out and be the best surgeons we can be this week. All right, let's stand, let me pray for us, and then we're gonna sing one more song. God, we just thank you for the chance to come into this place, for these images, this imagery of surgeons and vampires. And God, if I'm honest, standing right here, right now, oftentimes I feel more consumed with myself than focusing on what other people need. And I probably tend to fall to that vampire side. And I just want to say, God, forgive me. I want you to forgive me for the times when I've been so consumed with myself. And Father, I just pray that you would help us to know what to do with what we've heard this evening as we evaluate where we are. I just pray that you'd grow our ability to navigate these conversations, to think of ourselves as surgeons, to go out and begin to implement this. And we're not gonna be perfect. We're gonna have more failures than we are successes. But when we have the successes, it moves the needle. So God, help us to be persistent in this because we wanna be a part of the solution and the redemption of what you're doing in our world. And we know that happens through relationships. So send us out of here tonight, God, as relational surgeons, in a way that we can bring something to the world, in a world that's increasingly less civil. Helps to be givers, not life suckers, and inspire others to the greatness that you have for us, I pray.